The 60s are often cited as the years that transformed America, but consider 1959. It was an important year in literature, art, and jazz. Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro visited America. The microchip was invented. The birth control pill was introduced, and Americans died for the first time in Vietnam. Fred Kaplan writes about these landmarks and many others in 1959, The Year Everything Changed, which is published by Wiley. I'm very pleased that it brings Fred Kaplan back to the show. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you.
So should we call 1959 a cusp year?
Yeah, a cusp year.
The end of the 50s, the beginning of the 60s, in a way?
Or a pivotal year. I think it was a time when, up to that point, America was going in one direction, and after that time, you can see it going in a different direction.
Partly because of the election, or?
Well, I think it was things surrounding the election. Certainly John Kennedy was a facilitating figure, sort of a figure in all these things resonated into one man. He called himself the torch is passed to a leader born in this century. He talked about the 60s as the new frontier. The frontier had vanished. So what was the new frontier? It was the 60s. It was time. It was the future. It was now. It was the new. But there was a lot more going on. It was a pivotal year, as you said in the introduction, in practically every realm of life.
And what got you thinking about it? Because it's 50 years ago?
Yeah, 50 years ago. Several years ago, it occurred to me that a lot of my favorite groundbreaking books, films, record albums all came out in 1959. And this got me going on a sort of intellectual journey of, well, what else was going on in 1959? What, was this a coincidence? And then I came to the conclusion that this was really a very important and underrated year.
Even reflected changes in the way the Cold War was going. And we have these two controversial leaders with goals at odds with the United States making trips to this country. Was it just a coincidence that Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev decided to visit?
Well, Fidel Castro, of course, had just come to power on New Year's Day of 1959. Initially, he reached out to the United States. And the United States, this is often long forgotten, but the United States was the second country after Venezuela to recognize the new Cuban regime. A lot of people remember his trip in 1960, which was very hostile, and he joined with Khrushchev, and Khrushchev banged a shoe on the table. But in the spring of 59, he came here. He was greeted as a hero, as a savior, as someone who might break open the stiffness and rigidities of the Cold War. I have a picture in my book of him eating an ice cream cone at the Bronx Zoo. He spoke before 30,000 people at Central Park. He was hailed. The New York Times editorials were lavishly praising this guy. It became clear pretty soon that he wasn't what people thought he was.
But Khrushchev was also a major break from what Stalin had represented. We have a little clip of Khrushchev. Ah. Maybe we can play something.
There are some instances where you may be ahead of us. For example, in the development of the thrust of your rockets for the investigation of outer space. There may be some instances, for example, color television, where we're ahead of you. But in order for both of us to benefit, you see, you never concede anything.
In what are they ahead of us? Wrong, wrong. We are ahead of you in rockets as well as in this technique. I do not capitulate.
Well,
that was, of course, the Nixon-Khrushchev kitchen debates in Moscow in the summer of 1959. Sort of a hilarious incident. Nixon is coming off like a used car salesman pitching American technology. Khrushchev is being ridiculous. I mean, he's saying, like, oh, no, we have that, too. Oh, yes, no, our steelworkers can buy a house for $14,000. And then he came to the United States just a few weeks later. His goal was to backpedal on a threat that he'd made over Berlin. It was not just a series of buffoonery episodes, but he saw America, and he came back, and he said, well, you know, the capitalists in America don't want to have war because it will destroy their factories. And he made some steps toward trying to ease out of the Cold War, but that fell apart for a variety of reasons as well.
Well, you can't imagine Stalin having come to the United States.
No.
But Khrushchev did. It indicated a change in the whole tone of the Cold War.
He
paid a price later.
Yes, he did. But this was the first instance of personal superpower diplomacy. No more, no longer would there be these boring, useless multinational forums in Geneva where nothing got done and scripts were followed. After that, diplomacy was personality. It was media. It was direct face-to-face talks. It revolutionized the practice of diplomacy as well.
I mentioned jazz in my introduction. Two new styles appeared in the jazz world, although
there was
the rest of jazz remained the same, or there's always a continuity. But we had Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, which introduced another way of improvising on without using chord changes. And then Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Jazz to Come became a major cause celeb.
Right, absolutely. You know, Charlie Parker had died in March of 1955. And for the next 4 years, everybody in the jazz world was wondering, where's the next Charlie Parker? What's the next change? People were consciously and self-consciously trying to do something new. And so Miles Davis comes along with, it came out of a lot of different streams, but this idea of forgetting about chord changes, which sounds like an insignificant thing now, but that's what jazz was built on. It's like, let's forget about sentences when we write or something.
But he offered an alternative structure.
He offered an alternative, and it was based on ancient church scales, really. And the genius of Miles Davis and his album Kind of Blue was an artistic breakthrough that was at the same time completely accessible. You know, you take somebody who doesn't know jazz, thinks he doesn't like jazz, you play Kind of Blue, I mean, you know, he's hooked.
Become mood music today.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it could be taken in a different direction. But Ornette Coleman, who was always an outsider, came to New York in the fall of 1959 and played something, no piano, no chords, no scales, and yet somehow it worked. It took longer for people to get used to that. But see, I think one thing that was happening in 1959, why Ornette Coleman broke through to a public then and not a few years later, was because at least a portion of the population, especially in the cities, they were disposed to taking the new. They were looking for things new. They were looking for change. They were open to something that was done completely different.
Well, it's hard to imagine somebody like Ornette Coleman coming along today and making as big a splash.
It's
I guess
incredible.
More people were listening to jazz then.
You know, Ornette Coleman was written up not only in Downbeat and Jazz Review. He was written up in Time and Newsweek, in Harper's Bazaar. This was a huge thing. Gossip columnists would go down to the Five Spot, which was a ratty little club on 4th Avenue in the Bowery, and write columns about what celebrities were coming out to see Ornette Coleman. Leonard Bernstein took him backstage at the New York Philharmonic in Carnegie Hall and introduced him as the greatest jazz improviser of our time.
And Ornette wound up writing symphonies.
Yes.
But even though you start off talking about innovative jazz musicians, you end the chapter with Motown.
That's right. I think
which I would think has had more of a lasting impact.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I love Motown, and even today, if you want to get people dancing at a party, you put on the Motown records.
Motown came along. Barry Gordy set up the studio in January of 1959. The first hit, "Money, That's What I Mean, That's What I Want," was August 59. You know, the band, the Funk Brothers, that played behind all those singers. They were jazz musicians. They were Detroit jazz musicians. They would play. They would be in the studio all day playing. They would be in the night at night at the jazz clubs improvising. And I think what happened. I don't see rock and roll as a departure from jazz. I think jazz. I see jazz splitting into two directions with Ornette Coleman. Ornette Coleman took it in a direction that was almost like art music. It did become something that wasn't pop music like Louis Armstrong, Dave Brubeck, and Miles Davis. The other wing was Motown, which took it more into an R&B direction, but which certainly had a jazz vibe to it.
But even one of the major figures in the new jazz, John Coltrane, had earlier in his career played in R&B bands.
That's right. A lot of them did. That was the way to make some money at a certain time.
Jazz also inspired the beat poets.
Absolutely. Allen Ginsberg, when he moved back to New York in 1958, well, it actually goes back before that, when Kerouac and Ginsberg were students at Columbia in 1945. They would go up to the jazz clubs in Harlem, watch Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. There's a song. It's on record. Dizzy Gillespie wrote a song called Kerouac. Mm-hmm. It's on record. He named it after Jack Kerouac, who was one of the kids who came to the club. They were looking for... If you look at the introduction of Howl, Ginsberg's poem, he thanks Kerouac for the idea and saying that it's a bop prosody. That was a phrase of Kerouac. They aimed for a style of writing in their poetry, for an inflection phrasing that was explicitly modeled after bebop jazz.
Well, Hal was published in 1956, On the Road, 1957. So mm-hmm. how do they relate to 1959?
Well, a couple of ways. Both of them, well, they came out in 57, that's true. But it took a couple of years for it to insinuate its way into the general public. In 1959 is when you had about a half a dozen movies come out which had the word beat or beatniks in the title. There was the Dobie Gillis Show. Remember that, with Maynard G. Krebs as Dobie's bongos playing beatnik friend? And a very important event. In February of 1959, Ginsberg came back to Columbia and he gave a poetry reading. And none of the faculty came to this poetry reading because they didn't want to give legitimacy to this beatnik, even though he'd once been one of their students. Students crowded the places, 1,400 students. Diana Trilling, however, who was a great literary critic at the time and the wife of Lionel Trilling, who was sort of the conscience of the Columbia University English department, snuck out with a few of her faculty wife friends, and they saw it. And she liked it. And she came back, and there was Lionel in a meeting with some of his friends like W.H. Oden and others, and Oden said, "Well, how was it?" And Diana said, "Well, you know, I thought it was really quite good." And Oden said, "Diana, I'm very disappointed in you." And she wrote an essay about this in the Partisan Review, where she talked about a gap growing between the generation that was sitting in the living room ignoring it and the people at the reading who were. And this, to me, was the first instance of what became the generation gap.
Which somebody like Norman Mailer tried to bridge, and you start off this book and end the book with Norman Mailer.
Mailer was really an incredibly significant character of this time. You know, in 1945, he'd published, he was just a kid, he was out of the army, he wrote The Naked and the Dead. It was hailed as the greatest novel about war ever. It became a huge bestseller. Then his second and third novels didn't do as well. He fell into a fit of depression. He discovered the wondrous brews of jazz and marijuana, discovered the beats, decided to innovate a kind of writing that was really almost confessional, a mix of literature, journalism, and self-confession and self-analysis. In 1959, he published a book called Advertisements for Myself, which can be seen really as the birth of the new journalism. But it was also an attempt to make sense of this dual age, this age of where the prospects of infinite expansion but also instant annihilation, which I think ignited the creative energy of that era.
He tried to make a distinction between the beats and another kind of a new approach to the culture. He wrote a piece called The White Negro, which I guess was his way of talking about the new hipster, hippie thing that was happening.
I mean, this is where Mailer sort of went over the edge a bit. He talked about this hipster, this existentialist who looked at the bomb and said, "Well, if I'm going to die tomorrow, I should live to the fullest today." He got into a sort of romanticism of violence, which is probably the weakest aspect of his character from then until he died. But
stabbed a wife.
Stabbed his wife in 1960. He told the judge, "My pride, I'm proud of the fact that I can experience things that other people can't." And the judge said, "It seems to me that you confuse fact with fiction. You can't tell the difference between the two." But at the same time, he captured a sense of real transition. He says, "You know, I detect the whispers of a new era coming." And he really did have his finger on the pulse with that one.
My guest is Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column in Slate, also contributes to the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, blogs about jazz for Stereophile. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning former Boston Globe reporter who covered the Pentagon and post-Soviet Moscow, all of which seems to me to be perfect preparation for this new book, 1959, The Year Everything Changed, which is published by Wiley. This is a year also in which obscenity becomes a big issue.
There was a big trial that's still widely remembered, the Lady Chatterley case. This was Barney Rossett, the head of Grove Press, who's still very much alive, who sued the government for censoring from confiscating the uncensored text of D.H. Lawrence's 1928 novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was still banned in the United States at that time. He won the case. And that really opened up a whole new era of free speech. People after that point continued to test the boundaries of what was permissible, and they kept widening and widening over time.
And it allowed for more people to read Allen Ginsberg, for example, because Howell had been censored in certain parts of the country. Naked Lunch, William Burroughs' book.
Rossett published that as well, and there was another obscenity trial about that, too. That's right.
And didn't the creators of the pill have to deal with obscenity laws as well?
Absolutely. You know, there was a guy in the United States named Comstock. You've probably heard of the Comstock laws. He kind of helped write the laws against obscenity, indecency, and that included talking about or distributing means of contraceptives. There were, for decades, even talking about instructing women how to insert a diaphragm or something like that. It was illegal.
But Comstock was 19th century, and Margaret Sanger had won some of those battles in the 1920s.
Very early on, but the laws stayed on the books in many cases even all the way until the early 70s. Margaret Sanger was this firebrand radical suffragette who, when she was in her 80s in the 1950s, came to a scientist named Gregory Pincus, who was doing work on hormones, and said, you know, I've always wanted there to be a magic pill where women could have sex without getting pregnant. And he goes, well, you know, I might be able to do that. She funneled a lot of money to him. The research was done.
Paul Gerasi in Mexico, and then John Rock here.
John Rock in 19. They finally had to do human trials. They had to get a doctor. They got Dr. John Rock, who was the eminent obstetrician of the day. I mean, you know, mane of white hair, very respectable, Roman Catholic, which was very important. He put his name behind it, and they took it to the FDA, and the hearings were held in 1959. And if you look at things like the birth rate, at the rate of women who get jobs, who advance in the professions, that really is the pivotal point. Without the pill, none of that would have happened.
But they didn't market the pill as a birth control.
Initially, the FDA initially approved Enovid, was the name of the drug, in 1957, but only as a pill against menstrual illnesses. Okay, well, you can imagine all of a sudden 2 million women in America are diagnosed with menstrual illnesses and get prescriptions. So the company, G.D. Searle, didn't want to get upfront about this, but the commercial possibilities seemed so extreme that they decided to broach 17 states which had laws against this and the Catholic Church, which was very actively campaigning against it, and applied for Enovid as explicitly a birth control pill.
And that's
when all hell broke loose.
We heard earlier the debate between Khrushchev and Nixon, and Khrushchev was given credit by Nixon for being ahead in the space race. The Sputnik had been launched in 1957. How significant was all of that in this year, 1959?
59 was this is sort of what got me going on this book. In January 2nd, 1959, the Soviets launched a rocket called the Lunik 1, which was the first rocket to break free of the gravitational pull of Earth and to start rotating around the sun like a planet. In the next issue of Time magazine, there was a publisher's note, you know, they were very hyperbolic in those days, which called this a turning point in the multi-billion-year history of the solar system, and that a creature of the sun had evolved to the point where it could escape the gravity of its planet. And what this book is all about, really, is about various people escaping the gravitational pull of whatever endeavor they're happening to be in.
On the other hand, something that sucked the United States in for many years really started escalating in 1959, the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War, there was the first year in August 1959 when two of the military advisors were killed by Viet Cong. And it was also the year, we didn't know this until later, that Ho Chi Minh decided that now was the time to unify the country through military means and saw the growing U.S. presence there as nothing but a continuation of the French colonial presence. It took a long time for the United States to figure out that this wasn't just Chinese communist stand-ins. It was something quite different. But
But this was the year of the first American fatality.
Yeah, right. That incident in August of 1959. Yeah. Mm. It was the year when the United States started reaching out to the rest of the world in ways both good and bad, and that was one of the bad.
Technologically, it's the year that the microchip was developed.
The microchip. I mean,
may have had the most lasting impact of anything that happened in 1959.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you look around this room, there's nothing in it that doesn't rely on a microchip. But it's funny, you know, not all of these things are inevitable. The microchip was invented by this guy, Jack St. Clair Kilby, who had just been hired by Texas Instruments in the solid state department. In July, everybody else goes on vacation. He doesn't have enough time, so he sits and thinks by himself to solve this technical problem because they are running up against the limits of the transistor. And he comes up with a microchip. And in March of 1959, it's displayed at a radio engineers conference at the New York Coliseum. And, you know, the rest is history, quite literally.
Well, it winds up allowing the United States to leap ahead even in the space race.
In the space race, but computers, I mean, everything you can imagine. I mean, several years later, Kilby invented the first pocket calculator. You know, it's ridiculously big by today's standards, but until then you had to have a huge adding machine. It allowed everything that we think of as normal today. You know, in communications, in anything with digital displays and automation, that's the microchip.
So it's responsible for those annoying people with the BlackBerries who won't put them away when the show begins.
Everything has its dark side.
You end with John F. Kennedy's announcement about his intention to run for president, but you can only really say that on December 31st he was preparing to announce that decision.
Right.
So he was cheating a little bit.
There's a little finessing, but he was really running all through 1959. He gave speeches in 240 different cities. He turned away invitations for about 1,500 more. Everybody knew that he was preparing to run for president.
And he was already making a big case for the missile gap,
turned out not to be, but it was a galvanizing force nonetheless. You know, when he talked about a new frontier and vigor, I mean, he was talking about, you know, we now look back on it as a romantic thing, but he was also talking about going, you know, kicking some communist butt halfway around the world to it. He changed in a couple of years, but America was expanding in lots of different directions. You know, there throughout this book and throughout that era, there was this tension between hope and anxiety, between the idea of exploration of space, and yet space was also the arena for H-bombs and ICBMs. This is what the kind of thing that Mailer was talking about, what Ginsburg was talking about, and I think this dual tension, this sense of duality, which I lived through a little bit and you lived through as well, I think it did ignite the creative energies of that age, this sense of infinite possibility, but also, you know, possible instant annihilation. It lent an urgency to everything that was going on.
There are even artists who are making art that destroyed itself.
Yes, absolutely. There was that was the first year of the happenings, which was Alan Kapero. He just put on these spectacles where the audience becomes a part of the art. There's this breakdown. I mean, you know, John Cassavetes goes out into the streets of New York and says, "I can be a filmmaker." He'd never made a movie before. People were saying, "Well, I can do this kind of art. Art is said to be this, but no, I'm going to do it this way." There was this sense of incredible freedom of bursting through boundaries.
We see it with people like Lenny Bruce.
Lenny Bruce, his first nationwide TV appearance and his first record album was in 1959, The Sick Humor of Lenny Bruce. Breaking through a new, looser kind of language, talking about politics, about racism, about religious prejudice or religious hypocrisy, really. He and Mort Saul everything that you see on Showtime, Comedy Central, HBO, this grows out of Lenny Bruce almost directly.
Well, didn't the Guggenheim Museum open in 59?
In October of 1959, the Guggenheim opened its doors. It was the first American museum devoted explicitly and entirely to non-objective art. It was also
since then they have
they've expanded quite a lot, yeah. But that was Saul Guggenheim's vision. It was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, who saw it sort of in his own mind as something that would demonstrate the superiority of architecture over art. It was kind of the beginning of the superstar architect.
But it was also kind of the end of abstract expressionism as the dominant art style.
We
started seeing hard edge painting and pop art started
popping
right. up.
That same month, Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns had their first shows at the Museum of Modern Art. And, you know, Rauschenberg, he wrote later that he and Johns would get up every morning with a goal of moving out from the influence of the abstract expressionists. There's this wonderful story where the king of the abstract expressionists then, of course, was Willem de Kooning. And one day Rauschenberg goes to his apartment, knocks on his door and says, listen, I'd like you to give me one of your drawings so that I can erase it. And de Kooning understood perfectly what was going on. And so Rauschenberg used up about 40 erasers and then posted it at his next exhibit, which that angered de Kooning. De Kooning understood the what Rauschenberg was trying to do. He just didn't know it was going to be a public display.
We are going to go out with something from John F. Kennedy, actually in the a year or maybe it's 2 years later. When was he inaugurated?
61.
So, yeah. But we are already seeing the move toward this whole new mood.
Right.
What was 59 like for Dwight Eisenhower's presidency?
Well, you know, Eisenhower, I mean, in retrospect, we see that actually he was a smarter guy than we thought at the time. But this was the embodiment of old. You know, he'd had a heart attack, he'd had a stroke. He, at the time, was the oldest man ever to occupy the office of the presidency. The United States, which had been through a post-war prosperity, was undergoing a recession. There were articles that you can open up any magazine about the lethargy of the times, the doldrums of the era, and Eisenhower embodied that. And here comes this guy, John Kennedy, young. A lot of people thought he was too young, just like Barack Obama. Now, an outsider who broke through all the barriers and became president of the United States and sort of personified this sense that we were on the verge of something new.
Although in the case of Barack Obama, he follows a fairly young president. He could have followed Reagan, and we would have had the same kind of symbolism.
But a time when people thought that we were in the doldrums and dreadful and losing influence throughout the world, and it was actually in many ways the parallels between the end of the 50s and the end of our own decade are pretty remarkable.
You say that underneath the bebop-inspired improvisational music, the literature, the art, and even film, there was still a structure of calculated artistry. But aren't we talking about a time when things are being consciously broken down?
They're breaking down. I guess what I was saying there is the 60s went on, and as the sense of freedom and liberalism sort of degenerated into nihilism and rioting. And in jazz, for example, Ornette Coleman's free jazz just sort of degenerated into noise, this sense that, well, I'm just playing what's in my head. In the early part of this era, there was a consciousness of freedom, but it was structured. There was serious things going on. They weren't just breaking down everything for the sake of it. They were also constructing something new. And I think as the 60s transpired and into the early to mid-70s, that was lost sight of by the political activists, radicals, as well as some of the artists as well. There was this notion that, well, ugly is beauty. Emptiness is what we're aiming for. And that was an unfortunate extension of the trends.
Of course, it's been pointed out many times that the 60s did not start with 1960. They started with 1963 or 1964. Let's go out with a little John F. Kennedy inauguration to get a sense of where we were going. My great thanks to Fred Kaplan, whose book, 1959, The Year Everything Changed, is published by Wiley. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Real pleasure here, too.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace.
Fred Kaplan will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Park Slope Barnes & Noble store. That's on 7th Avenue at 6th Street. Up next, Peter G. Peterson looks back on his remarkable career, which has taken him from advertising to government to finance, and he gives us his perspective on the future of the American economy. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.